Manchester, the United Kingdom, Ling Pang on Bondi Tunes International.
Hi, this is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with singer, songwriter, actor, presenter Daniel James, courtesy of Livewire. Daniel James was one of the founding members of the pop band Yell. Together, they released three singles, Instant Replay, One Thing Leads to Another, and Let's Go Round Again. Now Daniel is back with a new single. Welcome to the show, Daniel. How are you doing?
Oh, Ling, it's lovely to be talking to you again. Thank you for having me on your show.
The show that you did is called Bangers and Chats, the radio internet show. Is it on Sunday?
It's on 20 stations, syndicated all over. Sunday at 3, it's all over the place. So if they just Google Daniel James Bangers and Chat, they'll be able to find it. It's 70s, 80s and 90s music.
It's lovely. And you know what I like about it is your details, your attention to detail, the lovely story that you tell behind the song. Once you listen to it, you just don't want to leave. You know, you just want to make sure you make a cup of tea before the show starts. The preparation that you put in, you must do a lot of work on that because it's so well prepared.
Ling, I spend about 2.5 days getting the notes together, because the thing is, if I give the wrong information and a band or a manager and the fans, if any of these artist fans are listening, they would complain and I would look a complete fool. So I really check and double check and try not to make any mistakes. And also I try to tell interesting stories, not just they went in at number 7 and then they dropped to number 9. I like to get the nitty gritty. You know, and you know, it's really funny. You say you get a cup of tea. I've got people who do their laundry. One woman contacted me. She said, I have a pile of ironing. She said, and I hate ironing. She says, but the time when I listen to your show, she says, I do the ironing, but I've sung all the way through. You know, I've sung along to the hits while I'm ironing. She said, you make my ironing day easier.
You yourself is a singer. I remember you talked about your life, how it started at the beginning and then being dropped by Simon Cowell without any warning. And then you lost everything literally overnight.
It's a very cruel industry. When I was growing up, there was a musical and this man sang, please put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. And I would say to anybody, don't put your daughter or son on the stage unless they are single-minded and very, very, very thick-skinned. Because when I first came to London, I didn't cope very well for a long time, because show business, how do I put it? You just have to have a really thick skin. For every one yes, you get 500 no's. And quite often the no's are nasty no's.
Because that makes it stronger, isn't it, Daniel? From a very young age, you moved from the northeast, I believe, to London because you believed that would help you to give you the acting career that you wanted. And eventually, one of the founding members of the band Yell in the late 80s and my early 90s, you released a few singles. These were two of the tracks, Instant Replay and Let's Go Round Again.
You got a special way to
have, you know, made a massive change in your life, but you did it. You took the risk and you did it.
I know this sounds really weird. I was visiting family recently, and one of my cousins, we were sitting in a bar having a drink, and he said, "God," he said, "you've had a life, haven't you?"
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I said, "Well," and he went, "Oh no, you have, you have." And I know this sounds really weird. This is just my job. And it, you know, I never see it as anything special. It's like I get up in the morning and this is my job.
Yeah.
You know, I just get on with it and do it. I never see it as glamorous because, you know, I've been on enough film sets and TV sets and video sets to know that, you know, most of them are held together with a bit of sellotape and a bit of glue. But that doesn't mean, you know, that doesn't mean I don't love it. I'm so lucky to get this second chance because, as you quite rightly said, you know, I've worked really hard and, as I say, I had a good kick in, a thoroughly good kick in.
Mm.
But, you know, I picked myself up and I'm having another go. And I'm so lucky that people are giving me the opportunity to release records and do interviews, and I'm doing some live singing soon. You know, most people in the industry get one bite and then they disappear off.
Yeah.
I disappeared off. It's a bit like clawing your way back up. You know, I feel like putting my head above the parapet and saying, "Just when you thought I'd gone."
I think meeting the right people at the right time at the right place helps, because you met the incredible manager, Jeff Chetwin, who put you in touch with Simon, and subsequently your career sort of built from there. And even though the at the time your singing career was quite short, but you managed to move to America. And from there, you managed to get into the movie business, and you appeared on a number of films as well. One of them scared me to death.
That was on TV the other day.
What was that?
It was on a Friday night, the movie Bloody New Year.
Yeah, yeah. Is it coming back again?
I put the TV on the other day, and there was a lady on there called Valerie Leon from the Carry On movies, and she was introducing a season of horror movies. And she said, "Well, we're going to a very dark movie now. This is Bloody New Year." I had a cup of tea in the hand and nearly fell off the sofa.
You look so adorable in there. Look at those long hair. Well, let's focus on now. Looking forward to the positivities. Now, you've got a good manager. You've got a fantastic personal assistant, Carol.
She's a wonderful PR. I've got a great team that make my videos and film with me.
Yeah.
And I've got great people I'm working with musically. I've managed to get a good team around me, and I'm loving every minute.
Recently, I want to congratulate you. Last year, you have the number one of a song, "Do You Remember Me?" Made it to the Heritage chart. And then your second one made it to the top three. Let's play this song, "Do You Remember Me?"
Takes courage to try.
The Heritage Chat is started during COVID by the wonderful former DJ Mike Reed. And I just found out recently he'd written a song and sent it to Donimos, and Donimos recorded New York High. I didn't know he could write music, but now your show, Banks and Chat, is also being broadcast on his station as well. So that's amazing.
3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, Heritage Chat Radio. People can just ask Alexa to enable Heritage Chat Radio, and they can listen to the show. My show goes out 3 o'clock till 5, Bangers and Chat, and then straight after me, it's Mike Reed with the brand new Heritage Chat. And I was number one last year, Would You Remember Me? Then Set Your Spirit Free was a hit this year. And as I say, Silent Night, Oh Holy Night, hopefully people will download it as a gift. You know, you can give it as an MP3, as a gift to people, or yes. If a concert coming up or a nativity play, or if you just want to put it on Christmas Eve with a glass of wine, or Christmas Day when you're having your lunch, Silent Night or Holy Night, you can download it on all download sites, and you can hopefully soon it'll be on the Heritage Chart and you can vote for it again.
Of course. Are you close with Mike Reed because of your music association with him?
Well, we're good. You know, I've spoken to Mike a few times. He's very professional, Mike Reed. He's been in the business so long and he's done a bit of everything. And, you know, there are so many artists, you know, that go on the chart. At the moment, we've got Take That on there. You know, we've got Ringo Starr on there. We've got the Beatles on there. You know, there are so many wonderful, incredible acts. And he's come up with this chart in lockdown simply because some of the main BBC channels are not playing these artists. And with this chart, it gives people from the 60s, from the 70s, 80s and 90s opportunity to play their new music. The thing about the Heritage Chart, it's big artists from the 70s, 80s and 90s with new music. So it's great that you can love their old music.
I think it's like like the equivalent of Top of the Pops, but on radio, isn't it?
It certainly is. And it's a great show. And as I say, Mike's at the helm. 5 o'clock on a Sunday night, Heritage Chart Radio. And the great thing is, you can imagine me, because my show's on and then his show's on.
Yeah. Is it a proper radio station that's running 24/7?
24/7. And if you tune in, you hear Heritage music 24/7.
Right. Dan, tell me, you have been invited to some Christmas switch on. Where were they at?
You know what, Ling? I've had such a busy time. There's so many things I could tell you, but I'll give you a couple of just a few of the highlights. Or November 30th, I was up in Ashington in Northumberland. Fabulous old mining town, the birth of Bobby Charlton and Jackie Charlton and Jackie Milburn, for anybody that's a football enthusiast. And of course, Bobby Charlton just passed away recently. So I sang live right in the middle of the town with a beautiful choir of children around me with little lamps. And then 2 days later, in Gosforth at the Grand Hotel in Newcastle, I sang for a wonderful charity called Hearts and Goals of the Northeast. And it's a charity that buys defibrillators for people who suddenly have a heart attack, and you have to get the defibrillator out straight away to try and restart their heart. And that's a wonderful charity, and that was great. And then the next day, I had to zoom down to Cookham in Maidenhead, near Maidenhead, the next day. So I was thinking, is my voice going to stand up? But we traveled down, got there for about 3 PM, and it was just getting dark, and I sang Silent Night, O Holy Night, for the light switching on in Cookham. So there's just three of the exciting events. Of course, I've been over to Ireland as well, to Belfast, and I've been all over there, and I've been down to Kent. So I've been all over the country, and it's been an absolute pleasure to sing it live and see people's reactions.
So it has been a very good year for you in promotion-wise, particularly this beautiful song that you recorded for this festive season. It's really sort of give you the final touches in it for this Christmas season. So everybody, you know, they must download your song. What do you think?
I've got a shiver up my spine when you just said that, this song for the festive season. I think that's the thing about it is, it's just that, you know, we've had Slade, we've had Wizard, all those modern Christmas songs. But like I said earlier, you know, when I lived in LA, all the radio, there was one radio station would just play classic Christmas songs. And that's the reason I joined these two songs together, just because I wanted to bring back that old-fashioned, warm feeling of Christmas. And if people watch the video, they can see the video on YouTube. They can see the video on the Heritage Chart TV show. It's a warm, cozy video, and it's a warm, cozy Christmas song. And people can download it and give it as a gift to their gran or their aunt, or play it on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve, or even at a nativity or a church service.
I think it's wonderful because you do Livewire Network TV. You have interviewed, including the remarkable Susie Cottrell, Fun Boys 3, The Tramps, Teresa Bazaar of New Dollar. Isn't that quite incredible? So do you find that sometimes speaking with them, is it sometimes relatable to yourself, your own experience that you've been through?
Whenever I talk to them, it's almost like we're just sitting having a cup of tea, nattering about the business.
Yeah.
The reason I enjoy it is because I'm in the business, and so I come from the angle of someone in the business, and I think they feel relaxed with me, and they kind of took their things out that they wouldn't normally let out, you know, because they feel.
Yes.
Teresa Bazaar was talking about when she first came in the business and how, you know, she was very intimidated by people, where she felt, you know, almost you know, on the floor at some point because her confidence was so low. And she opens up. I think they, you know, they open up and talk about things that maybe normally they'd keep inside.
Yes.
And that's my plan, is that, you know, because that's, people are interviewed all the time. And so I want to try and bring something different so the listener will think, oh, I didn't know that. You know?
Because you've got a different side of you, being an artist and a singer and an artist yourself. So you understand emotions and other things more so than a presenter who's never experienced those things.
It's like when you talk to somebody in the industry, you know what makes them tick in some ways, and you know what makes them tick. And so you try and get under the skin a little bit and get them to relax and open up about what's really going on inside.
Yeah, I like that. In your career, at this present time, are you happy where you are now?
I am very, very happy. I would like for 2024 to open some more doors in the industry. I feel the last 2.5 years, I've been catching up, and I've been running upstairs, and I've been trying to get doors open. And so where I am now is wonderful. And I look for 2024 and think, right, it's time to work even harder and open some new doors and expand. You know, I don't want to.
You also got fantastic managers and people working with you. Now you're connected with Steve Osborne, who's tirelessly promoting your record. And then you've got a fabulous PA.
That's the beauty of being older. I think you learn to judge people better as you're older. And the choices you make are better.
Yeah.
And that's why now I've got a team around me that I trust. And I'm enjoying myself. I think that's the key.
Yeah. All the very, very, very best to your promotion of the song. Hopefully do some shows, book up for some concert. Do you think that's coming?
That's why I'm doing these little things, these singing live. It's tiptoeing me back into live performances.
Yeah. Can you introduce your latest new single and tell the listener how to get hold of it?
So my new single is Silent Night, O Holy Night 2023. It's out now. Perfect Christmas gift to play on Christmas Day, Christmas Eve, or give us for a nativity or a concert. You can download it on Deezer, Amazon, iTunes, on Spotify, all download sites. It's available on all of them. And I hope you'll enjoy it. This is Silent Night, O Holy Night.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon virgin mother and child, holy infant so tender. Stars are brightly shining. It is the night of the dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till He appeared and the soul felt its worth. Rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. Fall on your knees, hear the angel's voice says, was born all night, divine, all night divine. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round young virgin mother and child, holy infant so tender. See? heavenly peace, sleep in heavenly peace.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with Daniel James.
Bondi Tunes International. From the golden sands of Bondi Beach, across your world.
Listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world, and we welcome our listeners on FM in Canberra, Australia, and the capital, also the capital of New Zealand, Wellington. Welcome, guys. I'm Henry in Sydney on Bondi Beach, and I'm joined by Thomas Booker, who is our North America correspondent, one of three, and he joins me now from Texas.
Yeehaw!
San Antonio de Bayar, to be precise. Thomas, you know, back in the 80s, there was this little TV show that was based in Dallas, Texas, and it had to be called Dallas.
Dallas.
You're from Texas. Was it popular in Texas itself, very popular around the world.
There is a certain portion of the population of Texas that responds favorably to the cliches of Texas,
yes,
which are, you know, are complete. I mean, they're completely bogus. Yeah, Dallas was an interesting soap opera. The problem is it was this alleged super rich family. I guess I can't remember if they made their millions off oil or if it was cattle ranching.
It was oil.
Yeah, okay. So that's the other cliche.
Yeah.
I think it was oil.
Yeah.
But
it's like you remember the Hillbillies.
Yeah,
what was it called?
Like rich.
What were they called? What was the name? The something Hillbillies? I don't know.
The Beverly Hillbillies.
That's it, the Beverly Hillbillies.
That
was a crazy show as well.
Well, it was. Okay, there's a problem with the Beverly Hill. Matter of fact, that's another caricature, and we could go into that at length if you want to, but it has to do with a very insulting. It goes a long way back to Virginia and Kentucky and the feud that broke out between the Hatfields and McCoys, which was actually a feud of land versus mining access versus railroad. It was a very complicated clash between two families that wound up being portrayed once the matter of fact, I think the federal government, the National Guard, had to intervene at one point when this. But this is back around the turn of the last, you know, that was the late 18th century to early 19th century, where there was the fuming and spewing. But reporter for, I think it was the New York Herald Tribune, one of the newspapers up in New York, went down and tried to do a background story on the feud. Mm-hmm. And he's the one who came back. He actually invented most of the narrative. And he came back with this really atrocious characterization of backwoods hillbilly, you know, superstitious, old-timey, and so he did the whole caricature of what they call hillbillies now.
Yes.
And and so there's something really sad about it, that to think that somebody would get rich in Virginia on finding an oil well, and the family gets wealthy, and they decide to move to California, which is, well, you know, it's just...
And that's what it was based on. The Beverly Hillbillies. It was really kind of uncool, wasn't it? Because they were depicted as basically rednecks.
Well, it was okay. It was insulting. But then the whole plot of it was everybody tried to use them to manipulate them, and it always wound up being Jethro or somebody else would see through it. And he had good old mountain wisdom and good sense. And so that was the basic plot of it, is that people would try to pull something off on him. But, you know, this whole absurd thing about moving in a tin Lizzie, an old Model T across the nation to California, live in a mansion in Beverly Hills and still wear their hillbilly outfits and cook outside, and all of a sudden.
It was a bit of fun, wasn't it?
It was a bit of fun, but it was also really grotesque, horrible television.
Yes, of course. Now, let's get back to Dallas for a second. When the whole meme of who shot JR came out, they got the highest ratings of any TV evening show in the world, and everyone around the world in about 100 countries were asking who shot JR. Did you care about that? Because I was a teenager at the time, and I honestly couldn't give a fling.
Well, honest with you, I didn't watch one episode. I was totally, I mean, because basically all it was a soap opera, and it was silly. And I was a kid, a very young kid in the early 60s. I had to live in Dallas for 2 years, and I didn't really have much of a fondness. Come to think of it, Dallas is a dry county. And I think.
Really?
Yeah. And so, in honor of, I mean, I need to, that already makes me wanting one. So hang on a second. There you go.
Oh, thank you so much. A beer comes across the planet 13,500 miles in less 0.4 of a second. Thank you so much, Thomas. It's very hot here.
The miracle of the internet. Yes.
A beer is just what I need. Mm. You just posted on social media a picture of an old radiogram, which I found very interesting, and I believe it was from your brother's attic. And does it have, now, when does it date back to, and does it have valves and all that sort of stuff?
Oh, I think it probably would date back to the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. And yes, it did have valves, otherwise known as tubes. And
that's right, yeah. They used to call television the tube, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And it was a tube. And as a matter of fact, I was joking with people about how when we were growing up as kids, we developed patience because we had everything we turned on had to take 30 seconds to warm up.
Television. Radios, even radios, yeah.
Yeah, we had tube radios that we listened to, and we had a radio tube or a tube-operated amplifier for our record player. Yes, he goes, I can send you photos of the oldies.
Yes, I was really intrigued by the picture that you put on social media of that old radiogram. And by the way, dear listeners, you know, this is probably where the name YouTube came from. What do you reckon, Thomas?
YouTube was supposed to reference the television tube, and it was supposed to be kind of a actually, you're right. At the time, people, computers were still CRTs. Cathode ray tubes. So those were all the computer monitors and everything were glowing.
Really? I didn't know that.
Well, yeah. I mean, back when you were, you had the big, that's why you had the big box of with the screen on it.
Yes, and of course.
And that was all.
No flat screens, eh?
No flat screens. No, they hadn't come around yet. So that's how they got the idea to call it YouTube.
Wow. Well, are you going to do anything with this old radiogram?
Oh, I just couldn't throw it away. I'm kind of like keeping historic items and artifacts. And I don't necessarily want to keep them for myself, but you know, I'd like to save them that maybe somebody would appreciate them and want them. So I do have a lot of artifacts going all the way back to family and, the 40s and the late 30s and all kinds of stuff lying around.
I love all that stuff. I really do.
Yeah. It's interesting to touch something that was, you know, that somebody was wearing or using or something, you know, 50 or 100 years ago. It is kind of a cool feeling. But this thing, I mean, I would really wish I could have been a kid in the early 60s maybe and had this around, because I did play with old tube-operated shortwave radios. And I did on winter's
so
days.
So did I. I used to listen to Radio Moscow. This was the 1970s.
Oh, yeah, the international, yes. Oh, God.
And shortwave was fantastic. And just to explain to anyone who doesn't know, of course, you know, there was long wave, and there was medium wave, which is also AM, amplitude modulation. And then there was short wave. Now, medium wave was very commercial, obviously, up to the early 80s when frequency modulation came in, known as FM. But short wave and you know, AM or, you know, medium wave was used commercially. From, I think it was from 88 to 107 on the dial.
88 to 107. That's the 88 to 108.
Oh, sorry, that's FM. Pardon me.
Yes.
I don't ask me what the AM is. but the thing about shortwave was it could go much longer distances.
Well, yes, and remember, you got to remember, back in the 30s, we had our Columbia Broadcasting System was in effect. It was radio. I don't know if you remember. Familiar name from that era, Edward R. Murrow.
No.
Okay, well, he was a very prominent announcer, but he had a very stern, authoritative voice, and he was working in cahoots with a few other people who actually went and when they were in Europe watching the rise of the Nazis, and they actually wired up a radio network, a shortwave radio network, so they could follow, and they covered the marches in Berlin, and there was somebody was on scene when they had the book burning, and they actually had somebody race ahead to be in Austria for the Anschluss when the Austrians invited Hitler to come in and unite with Germany. And then later on, of course, there was the famous This Is London.
This is London,
and that was Edward R. Murrow, and he was usually on rooftops with a radio set, describing the Blitz as it happened.
Gosh.
And you can actually hear the air raid sirens and the guns going off and bombs dropping and all of that. And he was standing there confidently and sternly narrating his way all through it. And all of that was done by shortwave.
Yes.
And then,
sorry, yes.
Oh, well, yeah, I don't know. Do you remember if you were listening to a shortwave radio that you would tune some stations that would have the weird kind of airplane kind of noise?
Indeed. Look, I was obsessed with tearing little transistor radios apart. Of course, transistor radios came in the late 60s in Ireland, maybe earlier in the US. But I was obsessed with this. I was obsessed with working on radio. I was also obsessed. And what I do, if you talk about the FM band or the AM band, I would extend the bands physically so that I would pick up police. I'd pick up airport conversations, people taxiing.
Prince Charles.
anything. It was just great, just breaking all the rules.
We had, when I was at the electronics school, and we had this old TV set speaking, it was a cranky old thing, and it was Dumont. And we used to have a long time ago a Dumont broadcasting system that didn't last very long. But this was a Dumont television. It was tube-powered, and it didn't have the tints on the channel. In other words, it was a smooth tuning, so you would have to tune in the station, and you would just sort of smoothly dial it until you picked it up, and you tweaked it back and forth until you got a good signal. But I also took it and tuned it all the way up, and I was able to hear cell phone conversations.
Really? So that was quite recently by comparison to me doing it in the 70s.
This was late 70s.
From Sydney, Australia, Henry O'Donovan on Bondi Tunes International.
If you've just joined us, I'm Henry on Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia, where it's extremely hot, but I've got a beer which has been sent to me by Thomas Booker, who is in Texas. Thomas, I want to talk about your time in Japan, because in 1985 you went to Japan, and you did mention that the beer was particularly good. And I've heard this from a friend of mine who goes there every year.
Yes, Sapporo and Asahi, and they had a few other brands that were nice. And I actually went and actually got to sit in an actual sushi bar and eat real sushi.
Wow.
Which was really fun. And the beer helped, because some of the stuff you really needed to wash down. But it was pleasant to be there, and actually, I was there and hanging, and I was, making friends, and
sorry to interrupt you. You were there for work, weren't you? What were you doing?
Yes, it was we were having a collaborative effort with the University of Tokyo, and they had I don't know if it still exists or not. It's the Institute for Space and Astronautical Sciences, Astronomical Sciences. And we were there working with them on the hardware that was going to fly on a space shuttle mission. It was called CPAC, Space Experiments with Particle Accelerator. And it was kind of a cool setup. It was what it was designed to do was to accelerate electrons and fire them into away from the Earth, and also fire them into the upper atmosphere of the Earth, to simulate aurora and also the magnetic the EM properties of the outer atmosphere of the planet from orbit. And that was kind of cool stuff, because the electron beam, when they fired it, you could actually see the beam. It would be a beam of electrons, but they would be illuminated, and they would form a corkscrew, and that was because they were following a magnetic field line. From spacecraft. Yeah, it was kind of really cool stuff.
This is going way over my head. you were working, your job was in Texas, right?
Yes.
And they're sending you to Tokyo in 1985 to do this job.
It was a group of us, yes.
How excited were you?
I was thrilled. It was an adventure. It was kind of scary, because it was very high visibility, and you didn't want to make mistakes, and also you're in a different culture, and you didn't want to. There are things, certain behaviors that you had to, certain attitudes and things that you had to take under control, because the Japanese had a different culture from ours.
Oh, they're totally mad.
they're pleasant. It's a very pleasant.
Oh, they're very polite. I know that. I don't mean to criticize them, but I've never been to Japan, so I've no right to criticize them. But the thing is, my friend who goes to, he swears by Japan. He loves Japan. He goes there. He'd go there, you know, 3 times a year if he could. But COVID kind of stopped that. Mm-hmm. He said the beer was fantastic, and he said it's a misunderstanding that Japan is expensive because people always think Japan is a really expensive place. And he said you just need to be like the locals and know where to go, what to drink, mm-hmm. where to drink, mm-hmm. Where to get accommodation. But I presume you were paid for all this sort of stuff.
We had a per diem compensation for all the food and activities. And it was interesting, riding the subway system. It was the first time in my life that I'd been inside a group, surrounded by, hundreds of thousands of people in a major city. And all of them, it was just this really strange experience that I was more or less completely all alone in this. But I didn't feel bad about it. And it was a very passive kind of culture. And I saw things in Japan that I was shocked to see, like homeless people.
Really?
Oh, yes. In the subways. They did have a lost population around there. There are other things. I did take a day. I got on the subway and actually mastered the subway system in Tokyo and out to parts.
The real Tokyo, not the tourist Tokyo, right?
Right. Yeah. Mm. Well, I did also. When I grew up, I watched all the Toho monster movies, so I was very familiar with Godzilla and Mothra and. The Mysterians, the alien movies. I still watch those today. As a matter of fact, I just last week tuned in and watched the original Godzilla, which was an interesting thing to watch if you want to see the in the context. But that's another story about it. But
Thomas, I saw a documentary quite recently actually on Japanese people who are lonely, and it's interesting because I'm not sure of population of Tokyo, but I know it's big. And of course compressed space, people have very small areas to live in because so many people in a small sort of area, big city but lots of people probably barely fitting into that city. And it was a very interesting documentary because there was so many people who are so lonely, and it was very sad.
Mainly elderly people, as I understand.
No, they were all ages. They interviewed young people who were just, they'd be on Facebook or whatever, or Skype or whatever, but they were just lonely. And I'm just wondering, why the culture, sort of why that was,
want to try to do an anthropological analysis of it, but
it's a very controlled environment, I think, and it is, to my opinion. Well, my opinion is that it's very conservative in many respects.
Yes,
and Japanese can't just go mad all the time, like we do in other developed countries, and I think that might be part of the reason as to why there's so much loneliness in these big cities.
Yes, it's. I have read the other thing about the fact that they're not having marriage, and their birth rate is way low.
Yes,
and it has to do a lot with alienation and isolation, and the fact that young couples can't get together and go out and fool around and have a good time and that kind of thing. They also, like we might be familiar, we had car culture. Whenever you wanted to go out on a date, you could pick a lady up in a car and drive out to a movie or something
like
that.
Like the 1950s drive-in movies.
Yeah, all that. But I don't think they quite have a liberty. I'm maybe reaching out. I was there in 1985, and I don't know. I can't speak to what the culture's like in the present day. But I've read and heard things about severe problems with alienation and
It's exactly what this was about. This is what
housing
was about.
Housing issues, and they do live in a lot. When I was there, I was watching them build all these high rises, and I talked to a couple of them, and they had a nickname for because they would have these huge tall buildings with very tiny apartments, and and they call them, they referred to the buildings as rabbit warrens. It was just this massive construction thing to handle the then booming population. But now I hear it's things are kind of in reverse. And
And you know what? Japan has definitely a problem where, very similar to China, actually, people are having less children.
Mm-hmm.
And the elderly population is booming. And this is because of, using the word booming, is because of the baby boomers after the Second World War. Mm-hmm. That was all going swimmingly well. But then now it's the opposite way. And all these people who were born, baby boomers like me and you, these people are getting old. Mm-hmm. And depending on the system, you know?
Yes, there's another aspect of it too, and that was the corporate culture. I forget what they call the name of the people who work themselves to death. I saw a lot of them on subways too, drunk executives.
Yeah, they drink a lot and smoke a lot, didn't they?
Well, they were obligated. This is back in an earlier culture, their cubicle culture, but they tended to have to, if you wanted to stick with the organization, you had to spend, you know, your 12, 13 hours at work at your desk.
Yes.
And I'm trying to remember the name that they had for the people who died at their desks. They would come in some... but they also had a thing where they had to go out. They had to go out and socialize. So they had to hang out with the boss at a...
And they had to drink heavily.
Yeah. And they had to do all that and then show up first thing in the morning the next day, which is... And that was... Now, this is an earlier era. This I cannot speak to what the society is like now. Mm. But...
I think it's the same.
They have the other thing that I heard was that the social contract between a corporation and the worker, and how basically if you swore your allegiance to a particular corporation, you would be employed for life, and you would have at the end of it, you would have retirement benefits and all sorts of other things. But then apparently the world planetary wide economy was such that suddenly those contracts and covets, I'm trying to remember the name of the term for it, but the covenants that the corporations would have with their employees the companies couldn't afford them anymore. So as it is, I think that there isn't that committed corporate culture that used to exist.
I actually think it still exists to a certain extent. And then, of course, was the geisha girls.
Yes.
We were talking about, you know, these overworked young businessmen being forced to really drink alcohol at night after working 12-hour days and socialize with their bosses. As far as I understand, the geisha girls would be hired to be at the side of a businessman, mm-hmm. and they'd be forced to drink as well. I knew one of these girls in the early 90s from Osaka, and she did this job in Sydney, and she said she doesn't drink, but she has to drink alcohol. on, isn't it?
Yes, it's kind of a teen thing that you have to conform to their little clique. And the thing that I was most touched by, because I was much younger then, 1985, and single and whatnot. But the thing that the women did there that I loved the most was the elevator girls.
Oh, please do tell.
Oh, well, no, it's just that they would have these petite, sweet little ladies.
I think I've seen that in 60s movies.
Yeah, they run the elevators, and so you would go in and... arigato, please to you know, level number 13, and she, level number 13, hi, and then she would close the door.
Hey.
The thing that they had was, I mean, they had very sing-songy voices. They sounded almost like little, you know, little angels and stuff. But when you got to your floor, and she would open the elevator doors for her, and she would say arigato. And I would exit the door, and I would turn around and say, you know, thank you to her. And she would go, ohau gozaimasu for the morning. So it'd be ohau gozaimasu and have a good day. And she would do it perfectly timed as the doors were closing.
Oh, very smart stuff. And, of course, she would put her hands together and bow.
Well, she it would, they wouldn't bow, but, you know, she would just be, but, you know, it would be a shallow bow, but with a smiley face.
Yeah. And that's a lovely thing. I love
I know. The elevator rides there were just really very pleasant for me when I was young, and they had these nice, attractive Japanese ladies who were running them.
How long were you there for?
It was 2 weeks.
All right. So did you have any romance going on?
No.
Just thought I'd ask.
I didn't want to get in trouble, and I kind of had, you know, had to be there and hang there. And also the other thing is you didn't just go out and ask a girl out for a date because that was kind of contrary to the culture. And I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just I was really worried about doing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing and getting in trouble. So I had to stick to the
understandable because you're there for work.
Right. Yes.
Just one more thing before we leave this subject. A friend of mine who I mentioned earlier on, he goes to Japan as much as he can. And he said it's so safe in Tokyo.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
He likes to do photography. He's got mm-hmm. a big camera and he takes lots of photos. Mm-hmm. And he bought his really high quality Asahi beer, is it? At a good price. And he wanted to go to the loo. So he left his camera on the table in the restaurant, went to the loo and came back and it was still there. This would not happen in your country or mine, Thomas Booker. Right.
Yes, and speaking of going to the loo, I also had to master the unusual toilets there.
Oh, yeah? Well, what's unusual?
You don't sit on them. You have to squat over them. I'm sure they've changed them out now.
That will be changed for sure.
Well, it was at the time.
Talking about toilets, here's another funny thing about the Japanese and how conservative they are when they're going to the toilet. They have these little machines, and this is happening in the present day. They mm-hmm. buy these little machines that make noise, some kind of noise, so that you can't hear them going to the toilet.
Oh, yes. I think that's, another interesting thing. The other
bizarre.
Thing also with the public loos they have in town, they were unisex. So.
Oh, really?
Yes, and they would have you would go in, and it was no big deal because they had to go. They were there to go to the restroom, and so it was no big deal. It's something that you did, so that they had men and women showing up in some of the places, and it was absolutely nothing threatening about it. Also had an old lady. Usually, they would have a very old lady who would be the attendant, mm-hmm. and so you'd be a guy who'd be there standing at. You know, doing your business, and along behind would come this old lady walking around behind you.
Really?
And you had to kind of get used to it. But once again, they compartmentalize things to such a degree that, unlike what we have here in the United States now, the big controversy over LGBTQ access to restrooms. I think of the absurdity of the whole thing because. In other nations, as a matter of fact, I think France, some of them have unisex restrooms. And facilities.
Well, you know what? It's so very Seinfeld, isn't it?
Yes,
they were ahead of their time because you know Seinfeld didn't get into that until the early 90s. You know the whole unisex thing. Okay, Thomas, we have got to go. It's always very educational talking to you. Look, thank you for joining us here on the show.
It was a pleasure. It's been a while. It's nice to have a good conversation with you, Henry, and I appreciate that.
Indeed. This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.